Today is the 11th of May, 2015, and we're in the beautiful trustees room at the library. I'm Carrie Klein, here with my partner, Michael Klein. And would you say my name is and introduce yourself?
My name is Peggy Brace, and I live here in Concord.
Okay, and your date of birth for some perspective?
12/28/1933.
Okay, great. Boy, well-preserved, beautiful.
It was a long time ago.
Tell us about your people and where you were raised.
Where I was raised? Well, I come from the Maritime Provinces of Canada. And I came down here to go to college, and I married local, and I'm still here. 60 years later.
When you say you came down here?
I came down to go to Radcliffe College. And I married an MIT fellow, and we settled down here.
How did that come to be? How did you wind up in Concord?
Well, we lived for a while in Cambridge, and then we came out in 1978 to Concord, so I'm a newcomer here. A lot of people have been here for generations.
Can you talk about what brought you here?
To Concord itself.
Yes.
Well, we were looking around for some sort of bucolic spot, and somebody said there's a house down by the river for sale. We came out the winter of 1978, where there was a huge snowstorm here. It stopped the whole town of Boston. And at the back of the house at Easter time, there were big snowdrifts here on this house that we were looking at. We thought, wow, they got really good winter here. So we bought the house and moved out in 1978 from Cambridge.
So you liked winter?
Yes, enough to buy a house that had that still had snow in April. And this year we had so much snow. I was skiing on Good Friday, just before Easter. But Easter had sort of melted into the fields. But it was skiing right out behind the house. It was corn snow. We could move it around. But it was wonderful out there. We went out for about 45 an hour all through the winter. It was terrific.
So this Easter you're talking about?
This Easter we skied on Good Friday.
In corn snow.
Yeah, corn snow. That's right. You can move it around and you can ski easily on it. That's right.
Like corn?
Oh, well, it's it means that it's not packed, and it's it's very easy to turn in it, and it's great snow.
Wow. So 1978, why were you looking for a home in Concord when you'd already been?
Well, we had some. We just thought we had some friends who lived here, so we sort of followed them out from Cambridge.
What kind of a place did you find when you...
Oh, here?
Yeah.
Oh.
I mean, what was this community like?
Oh, this community? Oh, it was a very low-key community in 1978. The houses were much less pretentious. And this house had been on the market from October till June. It still hadn't sold. It was kind of shabby, wallpaper peeling, and the plaster was sort of springing on the ceilings. But it was 1846, and it really was kind of primitive kitchen. Nobody at that point wanted it. All the Route 128 ladies wanted a more glamorous house than this was. It has 2.5 acres. It's right down along the river, built in 1846. Gingerbread with, it's a Victorian Gothic, very steep roofs. People kept saying to me, are you worried about the snow this winter? And I said, well, this house has been here for 175 years. It knows how to take care of winter.
And you say this was a low-key town.
Oh, yes. There were still people growing asparagus and... people had, there was a big egg farm up on Lowell Road. There were real farmers here then when we came, and there was cows down at 9-acre corner, and it hadn't, all the fields hadn't turned into planned residential communities the way they are now. You buy a big field and you put 20 houses up on it, and it's very grand. It's very different from when we first came.
It must be something to weather a change like that.
Oh, yeah. And there was food on the main street, the grocery store, and there was a Woolworths right in the center of town where you could go get your where you could balloons and things for your birthday parties. And there was a paint shop right in the main street here. There was and a shoe shop. There were real working things that you could use, not just elegant clothes or real estate offices or banks. That's what's there now.
Wow. How did all that transform?
Well, I think the prices for the people who owned the buildings and rented them to these merchants, the prices went up so high that they couldn't pay them anymore. And the change on the main street was gradual, but it was certainly very... there was used to be two drugstores right in the center of town, you know, right there where the toy shop is and across the street, and there was one up here where the Starbucks is. They were real merchants that you needed rather than elegant clothes and endless banks.
Were you involved in local affairs?
No, I really wasn't. A lot of people were on committees for this or that school committee. No, I wasn't into politics at all.
Just sort of watched it transition.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What about socially? Were there shifts in the social scene as well then?
Oh, yes. I think perhaps new clientele came in, people who were golfers. And oddly enough, in this is Thoreau country, but I think he's sort of kind of a hair shirt of a man, Henry David Thoreau. And I think it sort of embarrassed a lot of people who were well-to-do. And here's this man living in his little hut. Simplicity didn't really appeal to a lot of the new people moving into town.
Why would they want to move in then if this was known as Thoreau's community?
Yeah, well, they sort of filled up Lexington and they moved on further out. Lexington built on every field they had there right after the war. They didn't save much land, but so we've been heavy into trying to save some of the fields and the forests and the meadows. There's something called the Concord Land Trust, which is trying to be proactive, buy the land before it's sold to a developer.
Makes sense. What do they do with it then?
Oh, developers develop it.
You know. And the land trust?
Oh, the land trust keeps it for walking or dog walking or just landscape, just forests and... There's trails through it. The Land Trust has a series of trails through all of this. It's very impressive what they've saved. Land along the river that could be easily developed into grand houses.
So were you saying there was a different sentiment between the people who moved in and the people who were here before, who maybe embodied Thoreau's sense of simplicity more?
Well, people are kind of busy with their lives, so Thoreau doesn't, for a lot of people, doesn't really mean much to them, because there was something called the Thoreau Lyceum, which I used to work at when I first came. I must confess, when I moved out of Cambridge, I had a couple of paperbacks. One was Machiavelli, The Prince, and the other was Walden, and it was all turned yellow, and the spine broke. I said, I'm never going to read these books. I chucked them out. And when I came to Concord, I thought, wow, this is where this fellow lives. And I went working at the Lyceum, which is on Belknap Street, sort of behind the train tracks, the depot.
Belknap
Street, yes. And somebody said, what shall I get to think about Thoreau? So I picked up his journals and I opened up to a page, and it said, I was surveying behind Simon Brown's house one day, and that's my house where I live now. And here was Thoreau out there with his survey equipment walking all over my land. And he also found an arrowhead in Simon Brown's fields behind the house. And so I said, wow. So I went out and I found an arrowhead, a white arrowhead in the field, right there, because it's right at the confluence of these two rivers, the Sudbury, the Assabet, and forms the Concord River right in front of our house. And it just sort of blew me away. Yeah.
And all this came from Thoreau's diary?
Yes, his journals. Oh. His extensive journals, yes. And there were five generations of the same family lived in our house before we bought it, the Keyes family here in Concord.
Spell it.
K-E-Y-E-S. And yeah.
Pronounced Keyes?
Keyes, yeah. And the Simon Brown that lived at our house, his daughter could put a candle in the window and look right across to the Colonial Inn, right across the river. Now it's all grown up with trees, but it was just meadows. Musketaquit means grassy river. And there were no trees at all, right across the whole area. And so Simon Brown's daughter married George Keyes, who lived near the Colonial Inn, and he moved into a house with his in-laws, and that was the four generations of Keyes who lived there. But Simon Brown, he was the editor of the New England Farmer from 1850 to 1875, and these wonderful little, I think they were maybe seasonal, little magazines that came out, what's the newest plow, and what seeds should you buy that would really work. And Simon Brown used to bring sludge off the riverbed and put it on his fields, sort of organic farming in 1850. It was sort of interesting.
I'm trying to picture how he even procured it.
You could dredge it out with your horse, you know, put some plows in there and pull it out of the river and slosh it all over your fields. Yeah.
Did you give the name of that magazine? Did you?
The New England Journal of Farming.
So there were five families, you say, associated with this house.
Oh, well, just the generations of them, yes.
Five generations.
Yeah.
Can you take us through that?
No, I can't really. I've got a book about it, but it's gone a little faded. But and when we bought the house, the last owner was Henry Keyes, and his son lived in the farmer's cottage behind us. His sister lived in the big brick Buttrick house. Another sister lived around the corner, and then another brother lived up in the off the road. And I'm sure they were all saying, what are these people going to do to our old wonderful house? Peering at us from across the fields. But we tried to keep it as it was and sort of take the shabbiness away. The wallpaper was peeling, you know, and the plaster was all kind of falling down. So we fixed it up. But we tried to keep the tone of an 1846 house. That's even before Oregon was discovered, that house was built. You know, it's amazing. It's amazing.
And you found arrowheads going back.
Yeah, That's right, yeah.
Connecting you much more deeply.
I know, imagine.
Did it make you wonder about those native settlers?
Oh, yeah. I mean, right, they were all around, right there where the confluence of the rivers are. Egg Rock is where the rivers meet, and there's a little carving on the rock saying this is where the... give credit to the people who lived there before the white people came. It's kind of nice. It isn't just newly developed by the white people. They've been living here for a long, long time, the Indians. And this was the first town built in Massachusetts away from the tidal river because, you know, Cambridge and Boston, they're all connected to the ocean through the tides, but this was the first one inland that wasn't on a river. That
wasn't on...
On a tidal river. Isn't that interesting?
Yes. I wonder what that was meant for.
1636, yeah.
And you mentioned working at the Lyceum?
Yeah. Lyceum, it was a word for speakers' associations, and in lieu of television programs, you went out to hear somebody speak about some issue, and Emerson often spoke at Lyceums around New England, and you gave lectures, and people said about Emerson, I can't understand a thing he said, but I love his speaking voice.
So you connected yourself with this organization?
Yeah, because I thought, after having thrown out my copy of Walden, I thought, wow, this fellow has something to say. I'm really interested in this. Mainly because he was so multifaceted, you know. He was a philosopher and a writer, but he was a crackerjack naturalist. He did all these observations of nature all through the seasons. And he had a wonderful collection of plants, which he sent in to Asa Gray at Harvard University. To this day, they refer to it, and now that they talk about climate change, these collections of Thoreau are really way back, you know, 1840s and 1850s. And then there was another... a naturalist, William Brewster, who moved up, who made great calculations and wrote books about what he found. So it's the one town in the whole country that has this natural history going right up to modern times. And so when you talk about climate change, you know, they know what was here then as compared to 140 years later.
What are we seeing by comparison? Do you have any sense of that?
What's that again?
What are we seeing now?
Well, things that are coming up from Virginia. There's a wonderful fellow who does drawings for the Mass Audubon Society, and he has a wonderful drawing of things moving north, and he has spoonbills and he has alligators in the Concord River. I kind of love that, the fact that they're all coming up from your way, you know. Isn't that a wonderful thought, to having alligators in the Concord River?
From our way, huh?
Yeah, coming up from your way. That sort of intrigues me, if it gets that much warmer. A lot of creatures that we've never seen. I remember being in Pennsylvania and hearing this bird singing chirp, chirp, chirp. It's 10 minutes to try to figure out what it was. It was a cardinal. I'd never seen one up here at all. And now... this was down at Swarthmore. Never seen one. And now, of course, they spend the winter here, cardinals do. It's just amazing what's already moved north.
This past week, people have been commenting, too, about the weather. And
oh, yeah. Oh, it was yesterday on my barn door with a thermometer on it and the sun coming in, it was 98 degrees. when I looked at that, I went back on the hammock and had another mint julep. I mean, 98, it was just awful. I just, oh. And you can't do anything about it. You can't put another, you know, in winter, you put the muffler on, you're okay.
This is the 10th of May we're talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah, I know. So we've had no spring. We just had nice cold skiing weather up until Easter, and now we just, the flowers, they're just wilting, primroses. They can't take this heat. They're just lying there prostrate. Yeah.
And blooms that in normal, yeah, so-called normal years are staggered.
Yes, that's right. And now they're all out together.
You get the forsythia before the dogwood. Now the forsythia and the dogwood are all blooming in the same
And time. The lilacs all and the apple blossoms.
Yes, it's all coming at once.
Yeah.
I've never seen that.
Yeah, lilacs and the apple blossoms. And yeah, it's all together.
Is this something you've involved yourself in, the fight against climate change or the fight for survival in the face of climate change?
Well, climate change is one thing, but I have my own little campaign that I started. When was Al Gore's film?
Inconvenient Truth.
That was about 2007 or something like that. And so I went to see that film, and I came out and said to a friend, "What can we do to make a difference? For heaven's sake, you know, there's so many huge projects." And then I said, "What about clotheslines instead of dryers?" So the next year, I went down to Concord's town meeting, and I had an article that said we should all have the right to dry. Because if you live in a condo or one of these planned residential communities, you're not allowed to hang out your clothes. Yeah. In Concord itself, which is what, you got 18,000 people, there's 1,000 household units that are forbidden to hang out the laundry. That's all the little condos that are along and these big fields with the grand houses. It's, well, you know, there's your red dress. It looks fine on you, but if you put it out on the clothesline, it looks unsightly. It's kind of tacky, you know, flowing away from your house. So all those places, you never see clotheslines around them. One of the fields that's been developed here has about 25 big houses. No basketball hoops allowed. So they're sort of just for show and tell, you know. You don't, and of course you can't wash your car in the front. You can't leave your garage door open. You can't plant any petunias in the front because it doesn't go with the landscaping. So this is...
Let alone tomatoes.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I've never seen vegetables growing in anybody's front. Yeah. Oh, yeah. So this is what I've been working on. So I set it up in January at the townhouse that I want to make a presentation on the right to dry. People thought it was the right to die. And they look at me and say, "Really?" I'm also for that, too. I think that's a great issue, the right to die. But I said, no, this happens to be the right to dry. So they had it listed in January at the townhouse that this was going to be on the agenda for the April meeting. And there was a columnist from the Boston Globe who goes around to the different towns to Metro West to get some sort of interest that she writes about in the paper. So she saw this, that this lady wants to have the right to dry. So she sent around a Globe photographer, and he took a huge picture of me hanging my clothes on the front of my Victorian house. And then 2 pages of pictures of me in my laundry. And people said, "Oh, my goodness." I went to my doctor, and he said that he was reading the newspaper, and he said, "Oh, my goodness, that's one of my clients, my patients, who's there on the front page of the Globe." And then... That was me in the Globe with these photographs of me hanging out my laundry. And then at town meeting, I presented it, and somebody else in the Boston Globe picked it up, and I had three editorials on the main page of the Boston Globe about my project, three of them. And then there was a cartoon that appeared in the Boston Globe with me, the lady who's into the water bottles. She's trying to prevent the sale of water bottles in the town of Concord, 8-ounce water bottles. She finally got it passed after three meetings. But I took this down the same year, the right to dry, and it passed at the first town meeting by maybe about four people, grumblies, who were against it. And then the Attorney General, Martha Coakley, said, but this is a private agreement. If I live in your condo, I have to obey by the rules that you make. But one of our local reps at the Boston State House said, but that means you are forbidding people to save energy. Can't do that.
Well, hold on a minute. This is great.
Oh, this is great.
Okay. Yeah. The Attorney General,
she said, no, you can't have, if you have a private agreement, you're coming to live in my condo or my planned residential community, I call the shots. And this nice fellow who was a rep in the State House said, but that forbids you for saving energy. And he took me down to the State House to make a presentation, the Boston State House, about the right to dry. So I made my little spiel. And I think they trashed it. It didn't seem to come up for a vote, like all things that are in Washington never come up for a vote. So then the next year we got a new senator representative, and he said, oh, I think that's great. And he took me down to make another presentation. And one of the things that I say is to these mostly men in the State House, do you remember when your grandmother's clothes were flapping on the line? Remember when your mother's clothes are flapping on the line? Do your clothes flap on the line? And everybody kind of hid their head and looked sheepish, because obviously the third generation of people all use the dryer. I mean, put your hand in a dryer, you practically burn it off. It's a huge amount of energy. And when I was looking this up, 50% of our energy comes from coal burning electricity. And it was just at the time of all those poor fellows were underground and they were trying to save them. Do you remember when they were 60 of them or so who were there in Kentucky or West Virginia for a long time?
We lost 29
5 and a half years ago. But there have been so many.
Well, then this is what I said, you know, if we are saying we have to use our dryers, all those poor people, and I said Appalachia, are digging out that coal so we can put our stuff in the dryers. I mean, is that ethical? And people said, oh, but, you know, I can't, it looks tacky. Then a couple of people said, well, why don't you just put it in your living room then if you want to admire your clothes? And then there's another man who came up and said, it detracts from the housing. And people say, I'm going to lose the value of our street if I hang out my clothes. But the fellow who came up owns the children's clothing shop.
Who what?
Who came up and said, you know, we shouldn't have this. And I said, well, there's a man in Concord who has a clothing shop. I didn't say that it was the same guy. For children, and these lovely little girls' dresses and handsome little boys' clothes and really dear little baby clothes. Now, they look great in his shop, but wouldn't they look just as well flapping on the line outside your house? And then I said, furthermore, if you buy a wool sweater for the eldest child, it shrinks when you put it in the dryer, so you already have to go down two or three children in order to give the third child a sweater, because it shrunk down several sizes. So it passed wonderfully at town meeting, but it was the Attorney General. So mercifully, the Attorney General lost the last election. We have a new Attorney General, so I have to go down and beat on her to get her squared away on the issue of coal-fired energy furnaces, yeah, from Appalachia. It's scandalous, isn't it? 20% of Americans are forbidden to hang out the laundry. That's 70 million people in this country are forbidden to hang out the wash.
And then they have to be retrained to understand that it's a good thing once the laws are changed.
Now, there are other people working on, I think that Ontario, I think maybe Toronto, or I think maybe Ontario has outlawed that, you know, to put bans on having clotheslines. It's sort of moving slowly around. It'd be like the tobacco bill. It took 20 or 30 years to pass, didn't it?
And is there a way to actually encourage people to use clotheslines or clothes?
Oh,
racks?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's pretty obvious that. But the other thing is that as I walk through town, the first thing people say to me is, "Hey, great day for the laundry, don't you think?" Or, "Is your laundry out on the line?" And then people just do say it lowers the value of the neighborhood, you know, with the clothes flopping. And so when I did the presentation, I had at the town a meeting.
And when was that, please?
It was 2010. And April town meeting. And I had pictures of summer cottages up in Maine with the laundry. And they say, "Oh, I do it when I'm, you know, in my country house, my estate at the Maine coast or somewhere. I hang it. But I don't do it in town." And which I think is always interesting. Then I showed pictures of an Italian street scene where you go down the street and you bring these pictures home to show the locals. So if the clothes across the streets, you know, you say, "Hey, Pedro, let me have a hook on your wall and I'll hang up the laundry." And then Pedro gives another hook on the other side. And, you know, they have pulleys going back and forth. Oh, how quaint that is. But if we did that in our world, tacky beyond belief. Now, I don't hang it out on Sunday. Never on Sunday. I sort of, I'm at home reading the scriptures, and I figure that wash day is, you know, Monday or so. So Sunday's a free day because I'm too busy reading the Bible.
Don't you tell them that at the time?
The other interesting thing about the publicity for this was that the original girl who came in prowling through the articles that were going to appear at the next town meeting were women with children, preschoolers at home, little kids. And obviously the thoughts of laundry were at the top of her list, really, of survival. And the editorial lady who phoned up and had these essays, three of them on the editorial page of the Boston Globe talking about this crazy lady out in Concord. She had preschoolers at home too. So when you think of an editor of the Boston Globe, you think of a fellow in a pinstripe sitting around a big table, and laundry sort of isn't in their realm of interest. But here's this lady with the small children at home, both of them. Laundry kind of rang a bell with them.
So did saving money, maybe.
Well, it's the fact that they had to cope with the laundry. You know, I mean, how often have you put your children's diapers in the washing machine? Not very many times, you know. The women are responsible for that, really. And it hits home. What are you going to do with all this stuff? And are you going to hang it up? Or are you going to put it in the dryer? So they were very positive, very positive, especially the editorial lady with her three editorials about the laundry.
All positive?
Yes. Oh, very. Very. Yeah, well, but it's funny that people send me pictures from abroad of laundry, and then I get little things of little pieces of ceramic with the laundry. Somebody the other day came in with a coffee cup with
laundry seams all around it and a piece of wash at the bottom of the cup. She said, oh, I saw it in the catalog. I had to get it for you. That's all the kind of presents I ever get is laundry presents. Or another big mug with laundry on the outside of it. I have the
clothespins, yeah. Too?
No.
You never get clothespins?
No, I don't get... Well, yes, I do. Somebody moved into a condo and gave me a whole batch of their clothespins. That's right, because he couldn't use them.
They still can't.
Yeah, that's right. Because the Attorney General knocked it down, so... When you were young?
Now.
Yeah, I know. In our house, I remember, it was sort of a rack that you pulled up, and then you'd lower it, and it would be right over the kitchen stove, and it would dry everything sooner or later.
That's what we have now.
Plus clotheslines. We love them.
And plus clotheslines.
And we're selling our house, and we were telling the new owners about the low utility bills, and it occurred to me that it will be different if they choose to use the dryer. Very different.
Well, yeah, everybody had enough money to pay for their clotheslines. I mean, they really do it. And the other thing about a clothesline is that the husband, he can't afford to buy you a dryer. Really? Are you that stricken? Or the other thing is that many husbands, New Yorkers especially, I don't want my wife to hang the clothes out. You know, we just didn't do that in New York and Staten Island or the fancy places where they lived, and we don't want, this is right in Concord Center, we don't want our clothes in the clothesline because it's really tacky. The men making these decisions, which I always think is interesting. Yeah. Yeah.
So you're going to go back now to the new Attorney General?
Yes, I didn't, this winter, I didn't think it was the time to talk about clotheslines. I couldn't even get out to mine. There was snowdrifts were so big. You know, it's hard to get enthusiastic when the temperature's 20 below zero. I must say, I don't put stuff out below zero. It just really turns into a board. But the other thing about clothesline is the winter winds are drier than the summer winds. You know, the humidity. But the winter air is much drier, and it's the wind that blows them dry too. Nice stiff breeze. You don't have to have the sun. And the other thing, the reflection, I think, from the snow dries the clothes better. You get these big storms, and then you get the west wind brings in the sunlight, and it looks so wonderful. And the stuff dries very quickly. I didn't mean to get involved in this, but this is my, yeah.
This is great.
You didn't mean to get involved.
Well, I thought, you know, I really want to hear about my clotheslines, but.
Yeah, we do. And anything else about your place? There's rumor has it you have sort of an unofficial B&B. Or?
Oh, my word. What have you got there for?
Just a little note from Leslie.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, the fellow who was the authority on Henry David Thoreau was a fellow called Harding, Walter Harding, and he was from SUNY somewhere, and he came every summer and gave lectures of 6 weeks to high school teachers of Thoreau and the Concord authors. You know, it was part of many of their curriculum. So I put up Walter Harding, and then I took some of the other students who came, because I have a 5-bedroom house and the children were gone, so I put them up, National Endowment of the Arts, basically they all came they came with these things from, they were paid this stipend to come, so I thought I'd horn in on all that good money and house these people. And once I got the people coming from abroad as guests, and one fellow came from Santiago, Chile, another from Iceland. And
my husband was a tour guide around for MIT alumni people, and we ended up in San Diego, so we went to see him. It was kind of fun to be taken around San Diego by a private guide. And when we were going up to Iceland, which we went on about 15 tours, Iceland, the nice lady that we had a house, she moved out of her one-bedroom apartment, stayed with a friend, and we stayed in Reykjavik, right in the center. And then she took us all around to visit her uncles out on the islands. And it was just a wonderful way to see from this connection with Thoreau's N.E.H. Grant people that stayed with us. Sort of a reciprocity treaty here, yeah. And they, one American lady came and she said, she said, well, I'll just take my towels now so I'll have them. And I said, what towels? Well, for the week. I said, this is Thoreau country. You get one towel on Monday morning and that's going to last you the whole week. You don't need a fresh towel every night. So it was a good alibi to have Thoreau as your guide. One towel. Every time you wash yourself, a new towel.
Not in clothesline country.
No.
Were you wearing a little button that said, what would Thoreau do?
Yes. What would Jesus do? That's right. Well, yeah. I should have one like that. The only thing I do have is on my car. I had them made. I have a bumper sticker that says, question growth. And some people stop me, so I have them in the car and I give them away to other people, because bigger house, bigger corporation, bigger town, everything has to be bigger. You can't just have something that's just sort of putters along on its own steam. Concord, talk about bigger houses. There were a lot of small houses built after the war for soldiers coming home and what have you, kind of bungalow-type houses. And every day, another one is torn down. Somebody said a horrendous noise the other morning. It was the 7 o'clock in the morning. It was a house being just demolished with a huge noise. And they put up these enormous things, and I call them nursing homes. They have turrets and extensions and, you know, Palladian windows and five-car garages, and they just go on forever.
What windows did you say?
Palladian windows, those great big ones with a double set up above.
Going forever.
Nursing homes. You know, everywhere you just look, drive around town, it's horrendous.
Are you meeting the people who live in these places?
No, some of them are locals that have developed them. No, I don't really. No.
You go where the clotheslines are.
Yeah.
And is there a Thoreau Society?
The Thoreau Society, there again, it's very few people from Concord belong to it. We used to have speakers nights and at the Belknap Street, and the same 10 dozen people showed up. Nobody else was added to it. It's Thoreau's. If you're a successful banker or golfer or something, it doesn't appeal to many people, Thoreau's world. It just doesn't. And at the Thoreau Society meetings, there's the same half a dozen people who show up at the July. His birthday is July the 12th, Thoreau's is. And we have these yearly meetings since 1941 of his birth year. But same half a dozen people from Concord show up. And the rest of them come from Japan. We've had people stay with us from Japan and Russia. And Japan especially, because now that they're so successful, the Japanese, and they're beginning to think of all their material gatherings and the materialistic world that they've developed in Japan, they're sort of thinking, oh, what about that Thoreau guy? And they're very keen on him. And also in the armies of occupation were in Japan. Many of them were given Walden to read
And so they got into it, oddly enough. And the Russians come. And a lady from Bulgaria comes every... I mean, it's really amazing. But the locals are off at their summer estate, putting their clothes in the dryer and playing golf. So Nancy... Leslie must have said that I was into this world, yeah. What else did she say about me?
First parish? She mentioned first parish.
Oh, did she really? Yeah. When I came to Concord, the church bell rang and went up to the Episcopal Church, where I'm supposed to be. Where do you go to church? You don't go to church.
Lots of churches.
What?
We go to lots of churches.
Meaning what?
Meaning we do a lot of documentary work.
Oh.
Religious folk life.
Oh.
And sometimes we're in the woods, celebrate that way.
We've been to everything from snake handling churches to old regular Baptist singing.
Oh, how interesting, yeah.
Let's hear
what we get a lot of churches. I just wanted to make the point.
Yeah, because when I had a new hip, 1 year, and I didn't want to go to choir practice. I had to stand up through choir practice, and I thought, I don't need to do this. So I went around to all the churches in town thinking, what gets somebody out of bed on a Sunday morning and trundle off to church? Because it's really interesting to think of all these different, these are just Protestant outfits too, and they're all so different. It was sort of fun the way you were doing, no snake charmers, but a lot of variety of people. But the Episcopal Church, it's... I remember taking my mother to the Episcopal Church when she was in her 80s, and she'd get down and says, "My sins weigh heavily upon me. The burden of them is intolerable." I said, "Mom, what have you been doing at 84 that's so sinful?" And she said, "Oh, you just say it. You may not believe it, but you just rattle it off." I thought, I don't know about that. So I went to the Unitarian Church, and they're not into sin. They don't believe in sin much. Everybody's, "Hey, you're all right, Jack," at British Film. And I thought, oh, this is good. And then the other thing is that when you leave most churches, the Father, the Son, the Holy Ghost be with you. Who the hell is the Holy Ghost? And be with you forevermore. And in this Unitarian Church, they say, "Go out into the world in peace, have courage, hold on to what is good, return no person evil for evil, strengthen the faint-hearted, support the weak, honor all beings." And it used to be honor all people. They changed it into beings, so it included mice and ants and stuff. But it's such a positive thing. Hold your head up and do something important. And so I thought, oh, this is good. So I've been singing in the choir for 30 years or so. And I kind of like to be with like-minded people, And there was a very interesting guy from Washington. He was a Kennedy scholar, and he did all sorts of things. And his wife had died, and I used to do the flowers for 20 years at this church. And he came over and said, "I'd like to have some flowers for my wife." And I said, "I haven't seen you here before. When did you join?" He said, "I joined 9/12. I joined the day after 9/11 because I needed to be with people who could sort of mull through this and figure out what it was all about." He was this high-powered scientist from Washington. Showed up just so he would be with like-minded people. I thought that was a good add for togetherness of what it means to go to a community church. Yeah, it's a fun church. We sing a lot of fantastic music. There's 70 of us in the choir. It's almost like a community chorus. 70 in church choir. I went to a church across town, and they said, she's come over. I told them who I was. I've come over from the First Parish Church in Concord. And And I almost turned around and said, yeah, there's 70 of us in the choir and there are only 35 in your congregation. But I didn't. I was much more polite than that.
What do you sing?
Oh, everything. I mean, oh, I sing alto. I got an alto voice, yeah.
But what kind of, what are some of the great songs you sing there?
Oh,
like doing us a verse?
Oh, no, we sing a lot of, you know, Brahms and Tudor music, and there's actually 3 volumes of anthems that were collected to be used in that church itself by a local musician in the 1890s. It's a tradition of really good music in the Unitarian Church, unlike the Quakers, which is kind of dead silence. Right? We've been to Quaker service. Nothing happens at all. But the other thing I did, the flowers. And this is where we're talking about flowers all coming out at once. It was much nicer when you had the forsythia and then the apple blossoms. It's consecutive, but suddenly they're all out together and then there's none.
None.
Well, everything comes at once. You used to rely on having flowers for the church consecutively, like we were talking about this spring.
Talk about flower arrangement. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah. Well, one of the things was to use natural things that are blossoming. In the wintertime, we use grasses and what have you. But there was one nice lady who was a Japanese lady. She was a flower arranger. And I said, what brought you to the Unitarian Church? She lives in another town. And she said, I came because of the wonderful flowers, the natural flowers, and the beautiful music. That's what she said. Those are the 2 things. I thought, wow, there I am. Yeah.
How do you conceive of flower arrangement?
Oh, well, just, you know, apple. In a big building, think of the size of a church. You can't put little things in. You have to have branches or something big. That's why it's nice to go outside. And I live across from the national park, and I was in there one day picking something. I've forgotten what, maybe buttercups and stuff. And the national park ranger came by and said, you are not to pick in the national park. I said, it's for the glory of, I look and see what his name is. If he has a Moynihan, I said, it's for the Catholic Church. And then I check on who he is. I said, it's for the glory of God. I have to pick your flowers. So I didn't go to jail, which was nice flower picking.
Yeah, how'd that go over with him?
But I'm careful to notice what kind of a name he had. <Not all. laughs>
It translated to Catholic for you?
Yes. I thought, Moynihan, oh, he must be over at the Our Lady of Responsibility, whatever. Wasn't that Garrison Keillor?
Yeah, right. Perpetual responsibility.
Perpetual responsibility. I love that man. He's so fun, isn't he?
Dad and ketchup.
Yeah.
So are you a gardener yourself?
Yeah, I got dirty fingernails. I was out there today doing. Yeah.
Talk about that.
Well, I have flower gardens. When you go up to the, I don't know if you know the geography. You go up to the North Bridge and you look down from the hillside. There's a show and tell building up there, a great big brick house, maybe.
The interpretive building.
Yeah, for the national park. Been there?
The manse.
Well, no, the manse is the. Is down below in the valley, and that is the that the manse means a house for the Scottish clergyman. This is just somebody's private house up on the hilltop, which was included in the national park. There was thoughts of tearing it down because it didn't fit with the national, but it's turned out it's a great show and tell place for people to run the national park from that building. But they have books to sell, and they have a diorama that you can look at, and so that's where visitors go. And then they come down the street and they hit the hemlock tree and they back up and their windows wheeled down. Then they take a picture of my house in the gardens in front of it. And one day I saw this happening, and the guy came out with his camera, and I said, that'll be a dollar, please, to take a picture. And he said, well, I haven't taken the picture yet. I'm not going to pay you a dollar to photograph you. I mean, he didn't have any sense of humor about taking the picture. You know, I thought that was really, I haven't taken it yet. But, you know, you see English cottage gardens, the calendars that are just wonderful. The guy who took the picture makes a fortune, but the person who did all the gardening, you know, probably doesn't get a penny. So I have these gardens that are there enough so that you wind down your window and you take a picture of them, yeah.
Well, describe it to us.
Oh, it's just in front of the house, but it's right along the road where they go home. You can see them when you go back.
What do they look like? What's in there?
Oh, well, I try to keep something right from when the crocuses come up to the asters at the end of summer. It's quite tricky to keep it all going. Yeah. And then I have big raspberry patches and food. Yeah, I've got 2.5 acres, but it's, yeah, it's kind of fun.
Flowers.
There was a lot of trees around the house, and we took a lot down, you know, because they were right in front of the windows. So, and then I took all the foundation plantings around. 1846, you didn't have plantation plantings, barberry bushes and all that stuff. So it sits there looking like it probably should in 1846.
What does that look like?
Well, it's there are a lot of these Victorian gingerbreads along the Hudson River, I think. There's
but garden-wise, what do you try to...
Oh, make it like an English cottage garden, you know, roses. And this wonderful little gardens in England.
Stone walls.
Yeah.
Did you do it all yourself?
Yeah. Yeah.
You build the stone walls yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, the stone wall is very handsome on our house. It has a wall, and then it has an enormous pieces of granite that are sort of on top of the whole stone wall, put there in 1846 at the end of the property. It's really quite... Our house was sort of a gentleman's farmer house, you know. It looked very grand in its day.
It's like it still looks pretty grand now. People are...
Well, yeah.
Pictures.
Yeah, what are you going to say?
Oh, it's just amazing to me that a place at the confluence of these rivers would have sat with a for sale sign on it for many months before you came.
The whole winter, yeah.
You wouldn't see that now.
No, we couldn't afford the front door of that house now, I don't think. But it was a very primitive kitchen, you know. Kitchens were where the Irish maid worked. It really didn't matter what it looked like. And the fellow before us just had planks, so the grape nuts and the Worcester sauce and everything was so exposed. There were no closets and a little freestanding stove with nowhere to put anything. So it wasn't very user-friendly, let's say. So I think the kitchen was really very... Now you have to have a granite counters in order to sell your house.
It's pretty hard to hang them on a clothesline, isn't
it? Yeah, I know.
Granite counters.
I know. Yeah, so it was very simplistic, but I liked the shape of it, and I liked the size of the rooms, lots of sunlight. So it was kind of fun fixing it up. Yeah, Leslie came over to look at it one day because of the... Simon Brown, he's out, if you go out into the great room and to go up the staircase upstairs, he's right there at the foot of the staircase. Bust of him with his beards and stuff. He looks a bit like that. And that's the fellow who lived in our house, Simon Brown.
And then you grow lots of food in the back behind, in your garden?
Yeah, but I'm,
Amazing.
Tomatoes and stuff.
What's that?
Yeah, tomatoes and groceries. But there's a lot of farms now in Concord. It's great. Well, this land's been, there must be about 10. When can we quit?
We're doing great, but you keep talking about we, and you started off talking about your husband and you looking. I wonder if you'd talk about him a little bit. Seems like a partnership. So, to hear a little bit about him.
Well, I still use the editorial we, which is sort of,
Maybe once we, always we.
Yeah. This would have been our 60th wedding anniversary. It's a long time. Long time.
Who was he when you met him, and what did he go on to do?
Well, this really isn't so much to do with Concord. What else have we talked about Concord? What else did she say?
Well, she mentioned him, actually. I was just looking here at his work at MIT.
Yeah.
And woodworking, and if he was involved here, as you were, that's up to you, though. If you had enough, that's okay, too. So you're in charge. We've loved this all, so.
What?
We've loved this, so.
Oh, yeah? With my laundry,
all of it. But I imagine someone who wanted to be by your side might have been a special person, too.
Oh, yeah. We had a lot in common, and we really were mountain climbing. He's actually he's over in a cairn under the Matterhorn in Switzerland, because he was a mountain person, and he did a lot of geology of the Swiss Alps. So there's a cairn about... Yay high. And his name underneath it, and that's where he is. Imagine.
What is his name?
It probably says on that little list. Opa, which is a word for grandfather. We all called him Opa. But imagine being, people said, oh, don't you want him in the local graveyard? Well, he was an outdoor person. So he's in under the Matterhorn. Ever been to the Matterhorn? Ever been to Zurich? Oh, wonderful. Wonderful. Oh. Yeah.
Fellow skiers, were you?
Yeah. Hikers, Grand Canyon 3-4 times. Yeah. Yeah, it was fun.
Man of the earth and skies.
Yeah. He ran the whole world, actually, at MIT. People say, what did he do? He ran the whole world.
What does that mean?
Well, Earth, planetary, and atmospheric sciences. It says on that thing. Okay. So, there you have it.
This is great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. This is terrific.
You're a phenomenon. Everybody told us you would be, but we always wait to learn for ourselves. Really inspiring.
Yeah, I suppose when I say I'm not political, I'm interested in the right to die, too, though. What do you think about
it? Talk about that.
Well, this nice girl from California who moved to Oregon so she could die the way she wanted to. I mean, don't you think? I noticed the Pope was very cross at her. The Pope said, oh, you can't do that. You got to suffer. But I think, after you've outstayed your welcome, for heaven's sake, why do you want to linger on? Yeah? You into that, too?
Yeah. We are part of a little group at home of people who are like-minded on that issue.
Have you brought it up in the state yet? Is it because we tried to do it here. It lost by a few counts. I think it lost in Maine by a very few counts, too. Have you had it on the agenda for West Virginia?
No, we have a piece of land for burials.
Green burial.
For green burials.
It's a slightly different issue, but the idea of people making advanced preparation and thinking about what's right and just for them probably overlaps.
But what about the fact that, assisted suicide, I suppose is what you call it, or checking out. What do you think about checking yourself out?
personally?
Yeah.
Let's talk about us when we're not recording about you. And so.
Well, you can turn
yeah,
that
we
thing.
Okay.
We'll,
yeah.
We'll turn it off if you want.
Okay.
But, I mean, I think
I'll
this is a big
she's
issue.
She's done, so
yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
We think it's important.
Okay. So continue.
Okay, the right to dry is similar to the right to die. And I do think that the right to die should be legislated for real, that you can do that without being stigmatized by what the church, the pope, the society. Why should you have to suffer endlessly? Do you know Atul Gawande, who's written these books? Do you know him? He writes for The New Yorker. And he wrote a book called Mortality. It came out recently, and it's the whole thing about over medications and tests and what have you. Sort of too much. Let you right to die, yeah. I think it's a very important issue. Yes, I have three children, but two of them live in Seattle with their collectively four grandchildren, and one lives in Amsterdam. And to have them running back and forth every time I have some problem, I mean, it's a long way, 3,000 miles to the west and 3,000 miles to the east. And they say, well, you should have your family around you. that's a long way. And if I feel that I've outstayed my welcome is what I kind of like as a phrase, you know, hey, pull the plug. Why not? Why not?
As in you wouldn't feel welcome anymore, or say a little more about that?
I wouldn't feel welcome?
You wouldn't feel welcome anymore? Or when
oh, well, you've outstayed, I mean, you're here and you've had a good life and you've outstayed your welcome. Yeah, you know, when you're born, hopefully people are pleased to see you. But, yeah, I think that, you know, only recently have this battery of machines and medicines and tests and stuff. It's quite recent, really, since the Second World War. But as Atul Gawande says, it's sort of gotten beyond sensible procedures, really. I thought his book was very, very profound. He talked, I think it's Atul, A-T-U-L, G-W-A-N-D-E.
I'm trying to remember the name of the book.
Yeah, or Mortality.
On Mortality.
Yeah.
Is there a group around here?
No, I don't think, I don't know of one, and I don't belong to one. But, you know, you talk about it the way you now that we're all getting older, I mean, I'm 81. I'll be 82 this winter.
You got to die with your boots on.
What?
You got to die with your ski boots on.
I know. Actually, I do. I ski with a friend because the new ski bindings, you have to be standing up to punch down on the little lever to get your skis off. If you fall, if I fall down, I can't get up. So we have a little phone service where we talk. This was all winter long. It was so great. But we tell, when are you available? Well, I won't be around until 3 o'clock this afternoon. All right, let's go out at 4. And we ski up over the fields and around for maybe about an hour. And sometimes when the sun sets, I said, I'd love to go out and ski, watch it over the western sky. But if I fall down and she's not there with me, they're online, and then I can hear the coyotes circling around looking for their evening meal. There's coyotes up there all over the woods, and I thought, oh, do I really want to be out there alone? So we ski together, and we ski, you know, all over the national park and what have you, and it's really fun. Many people say, oh, I hated the winter. I never got outside. I mean, hey, put on your muffler and go outside. Yeah, that's really great.
You're really great. Thank you so much.
I don't know about that. Oh,
sure. Okay, we're running again.
when I made the presentation at town meeting, it was 40 years that they had had this, what was it called? Earth Day. It was 40 years ago when I had presented this. And I said, you know, we've had 40 years, and what have we done? We go to meetings, we go to seminars, we take courses on what's to do, and what have we done? Nothing. Then I said, what can each of us do which collectively can make an enormous difference in our use of energy? That's the question. Long pause. The answer, my friends, is laundry blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind. And I had a picture of a girl reaching for her laundry out in Prince Edward Island. It's just blowing in the sky. She can't reach it, but it's blowing in the wind. And everybody clapped and hooted, and the monitor said, no, you're not supposed to clap at town meeting, and there should be no comments from the audience. And he was very cross. Everybody started to laugh. And then they always say, are you going to come to town meeting? Are you going to sing again? And I said, well, no. No, I don't think so.
Thank you.
Isn't that a kind of a fun story?
That's great.
The answer, my friend, is laundry blowing in the wind.
Okay.
The other thing about the town meeting, it was the fourth night of town meeting, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, at 9:30 at night. Everybody bored to tears with all the issues and the monies and stuff. But people sort of came back. They said, oh, I want to hear what she has to say. And a lot of my friends showed up the last Wednesday. They came Wednesday thinking I was going to do it then. And 9:30 at night, there they all were. Listening to my presentation, thinking, what on earth is she going to say? Yeah, oh, it was amazing. And the other lady made a presentation to forbid the sale of 8-ounce water bottles in town, and that took her 3 tries to get through that. She didn't have very good presentation. She didn't have any good pictures. And finally, last year, it went through, and you cannot buy legally an 8-ounce single water bottle. It's the first town in the country to have that. In the whole USA, Concord, you can't buy an 8-ounce water bottle in Concord.
What did town meeting finally pass on yours?
They passed an ordinance that said that you can't forbid people hanging up the laundry. And
because of the energy issue?
Yeah. Yeah, and that's right. It passed in town meeting. It passed that you don't. The town. What am I doing? Everybody has the right to hang out their laundry in Concord, and you can't forbid them from saving money and doing that, saving energy and doing that, hanging out the laundry. But so it passed in Concord, but the Attorney General said, no, you can't force the state to horn in on an agreement between two people about living in a condo or whatever. That's a private arrangement, and the state has no business into it.
But the state legislature is taking a second look at that.
The local politicians took me in twice. One was the representative, another was a senator, saying we really ought to have this withdrawn, that people have the power to forbid you from saving energy. And think of the whole country. 60 million people are forbidden to hang out the laundry. That's in the Sun Belt. And then in the summertime, it goes right up to Minnesota. 20% of the population need that Appalachian coal. Got to keep those people digging away.
In a country, in a nation that does not have an energy policy. We don't have a national energy policy, so why should any state have it?
That's right. And also, why should we have a national EPA that's going to restrict all kinds of things, you know, the birds and the bees and
environmental things when each state has an environmental policy. You know, 48 different or 50 different versions of EPA, some lax, some stringent, but no national policy.
No national policy.
It's crazy. It's shameful, isn't it? I mean, when you think of a river going through 8 states, and yet each little state has a control over what's going on in that river. There's a wonderful fellow who teaches landscape architecture planning, and he says, think locally, plan regionally, you know, and then globally, so that it's the regions, you know, where the mountain ranges and the rivers make a little entity. That's where you plan. You don't have these artificial town borders or countries too. Plan locally, plan regionally. We don't do that. But the EPA, you know, we don't want, and public television, public radio, I mean, they're dreadful. We've got to get rid of those. That was a radio. Was it Inhofer? Who was he from? He doesn't believe in global warming, never has, never is going to. Out with the EPA, out with public television. No more public, national public radio newscast at 6 o'clock. Out. It's sort of grim, isn't it? Well, what fun to have you guys come up and do this. My goodness.
Thank you. It's our pleasure.
We love what we do.
I bet you do.